In the year 1991, U.S. Flight 1313 soared unknowing unto its death. As the vessel sank into the ocean's depths, three boys washed ashore on Skull Face Island. Near death, pursued by vicious creatures, the boys stumbled upon shelter. Who built it and for what purpose, none could say. But, to their shock and amazement, a 55-inch TV glowed within, streaming every movie ever made.
I'd stick my neck out for nobody.
What the hell is it?
You're an inhuman monster!
I said good day!
After 20 years struggling for survival, they managed to repair the shelter's communication device. Perhaps someday, they'll be rescued. But until then, they'll watch and discuss movies, hoping, praying you're listening.
Hello there, this is Adam Frazier, and you are listening to Skullface Island, the official movie podcast of geeksofdoom.com. As always, I'm joined by Tom Skerritt's stunt beard, David Allen.
Oh, that's just sweet.
And the island's current record holder for most repeat viewings of Julie and Julia, producer Tim Grant.
Hello, thank you. It's true.
Today on the show, we'll discuss Ruben Fleischer's new film, Gangster Squad, as well as the latest news on Man of Steel, The Master, Dread, and Guardians of the Galaxy. We'll also talk about the best performances by actors and actresses in leading roles of 2012. But first, it's time for our Skullface Selects, also known as our Picks of the Week. David, your pick?
My pick this week is Ryan Fleck's Half Nelson, starring Ryan Gosling and Anthony Mackie. It's an incredible film about race, education, and meaningful relationships that arise from both of those sources. Void of the easy emotional punches and surface music that normally accompanies these films, Half Nelson also reminds me that Gosling and Mackie are incredibly talented, and it's streaming now on Netflix.
My pick is For a Good Time Call, which was The Bridesmaids of 2012, and it was ignored by practically everyone except us. Mm-hmm. We reviewed Jamie Travis's hilarious and endearing female-driven comedy in episode 9, so if you missed that, check it out. The film, which stars Ari Grainer, Lauren Miller, Justin Long, and Mark Webber, is now available on DVD and Blu-ray, and I highly suggest you check it out. Tim?
My pick is the superb crime noir Brick, directed by Rian Johnson. So it's a darkly clever genre mashup that really escapes its own novelty, in a sense, and instead uses its style to tell a compelling story. One of my favorite movies, quite honestly. And it's currently streaming on Netflix, Instant, and Hulu.
That is a good pick, and also the resurgence of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's acting career. Those are some great picks. Be sure to check those out. Let's just jump right into it. Tim, flip the switch on the Geek-O-Matic Telefax.
All right, first headline. Oh, this is a good one. This is going to make you pretty excited, I think.
Ooh.
Dread tops DVD and Blu-ray sales charts.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Dread had a production budget of $50 million, and unfortunately, the domestic total gross was about $13 million.
Boo.
A bomb. Worldwide gross was a little better, $32.7 million, but it's still pretty safe to say that Dread was a box office disaster.
Yeah.
This is great news, though, because Dread claimed the number one spot on the DVD and Blu-ray charts with, I think, 650,000 units sold.
Yeah, which is huge.
Which makes it currently the best-selling new release of the year. And this signals that there might be a home video audience for this type of movie, even though it bombed. And maybe there's still hope for Dread to come back with a balls to the wall sequel. Next headline here. Hold on, Marvel is interested in Jim Carrey and or Adam Sandler for Guardians of the Galaxy. Our friends at Latino Review have received some intel from their trusted sources that Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler are being considered for a key voice role in James Gunn's cosmic comic book adventure. And I guess really all signs point to Rocket Raccoon on this one, right? They're looking for a humorous big-name voice to put behind the character. And all I can say to this is no, 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 no. I mean, maybe Jim Carrey is okay, but I just can't bring myself to even consider for a second Adam Sandler being in a Marvel movie. I don't care if it's his goddamn voice. I don't care if it's his name as an executive producer. I want him nowhere near anything I enjoy. He is on his own subgenre of shit I hate, and I would like for him to stay there. Next headline.
Let's see here. It looks like Man of Steel receives a PG-13 rating from the MPAA.
Zack Snyder's Superman movie has received the rating for, quote, intense sequences of sci-fi violence, action and destruction, and some language.
This is a non-headline. It's like saying a car has four wheels.
I think it is legitimate because Superman has a history of not doing a goddamn thing in movies.
Right. That's true.
And it'll be amazing to watch a PG-13 movie where no one even throws a goddamn punch or does anything interesting. I guess lifting a school bus out of a river or working on a deadliest catch fishing boat is now considered intense, violent action. All I'm saying is, if you're going to put this news out, oh, guys, get ready. We got a PG-13 Superman coming at you. How about you show me some of that action in the goddamn trailer? Instead of a generic city crumbling to the ground shot that could have came out of Green Lantern or fucking 2012 with John Cusack.
I just can't wait for you to eat these words.
I can't wait either. I'm sorry if I'm a little on edge. I haven't been sleeping much lately. I was up all night trying to trim and shape my eyebrows to match Michael Keaton's circa 1992's Batman Returns.
It looks good.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, it's time to, as Nick Nolte would say, wage a war for the soul of Los Angeles. It's movie time.
Based on Tales from the Gangster Squad by Paul Lieberman, Gangster Squad is the latest film by director Ruben Fleischer, and it stars Josh Brolin and Ryan Gosling as members of a secret police unit that wages an anything-goes war against notorious mobster Mickey Cohen and the corruption that plagues the City of Angels.
We're losing Los Angeles to an eastern crook.
I'm the future.
This isn't a crime wave. It's enemy occupation. I need you to wage war against Mickey Cohen.
I'm looking to put a squad together.
Listen.
A small squad. Five, maybe six guys.
Going up against 40?
Well, you gotta die of something.
Sean Penn portrays the legendary Brooklyn-born Jewish mobster Mickey Cohen as a complete cartoon character. I mean, this is a mix of James Cagney in The Public Enemy and William Forsythe's Flat Top in Warren Beatty's 1990 comic strip movie, Dick Tracy.
Good reference.
Thank you. Penn's over-the-top performance is way more reminiscent of like Jack Nicholson's Joker from 1989's Batman than a realistic interpretation of really one of the most famous gangsters in history. And for most of the film, I awaited a scene in which Cohen would swing around in an office chair, stare out from under his caveman brow, and mutter, "Wait till they get a load of me." I mean, just Google a goddamn picture of Mickey Cohen. He looked nothing like this. He was a short, stocky man. As for the good guys, Brolin, Gosling, Anthony Mackie, Giovanni Ribisi, they kind of form this Avengers-esque squad of crime fighters with a grizzled, asphalt-gargling Nick Nolte as their Nick Fury. Mackie's good with knives. Ribisi is the surveillance expert. Gosling is the silver-tongued ladies' man in love with Cohen's main squeeze, who's played by Emma Stone. And Brolin, of course, is the unwavering hero, the Captain America, if you will, to Sean Penn's comic book bad guy. And really, it's always the same with these kinds of movies. The beyond rich, megalomaniacal crime boss takes over a city with a bankroll of crooked cops and politicians and battling a small group of do-gooders who refuse to be bought. Fleischer's film stitches together every cliche of nearly every gangster noir movie you have or haven't seen. I'm talking Chinatown, The Untouchables, Goodfellas, Godfather, Casino, L.A. Confidential, you name it, it's probably in there. Gangster Squad is just another shoot-'em-up movie that lacks the intricacies and depth of the films and the video games that it so desperately wants to emulate. It's as fun and entertaining as any cartoon, I guess, but by appealing to the widest possible audience, which this movie does, Fleischer has created an incredibly generic, forgettable movie. This is mainly for younger audiences who have never seen any of these movies and don't realize that it not only has it been done before, but it's been done way better. Do yourself a favor and just pick up L.A. Confidential on Blu-ray instead. It's the best movie of this neo-noir Los Angeles subgenre, so I would say don't even bother.
In fairness, Ryan Gosling does look really good in the film.
God, he does.
So I tend to agree with most of what Adam just said about the film, so I'll try not to repeat. And I'll try and talk about some other stuff that I kind of picked up. The film follows in a long tradition of noir cinema. In the early days, we had masterpieces of black and white cinema that took the aesthetic ideas from German Impressionism and applied them to the mean city streets. Over the years, with the introduction of color and the 70s really mastering the idea of the anti-hero, the genre had to change. Some internalized the ideas of noir, like in Taxi Driver or a little bit later in Fight Club. Others tried to shake it up a little by messing with setting and plot, like in Chinatown or in Blade Runner. But more mainstream efforts like L.A. Confidential or Black Dahlia return to the source and like the same period, but attempt to inject a bit more realism. L.A. Confidential, as Adam has mentioned, I think succeeds gloriously in this effort. Dahlia,
not so much.
Though there is a really great crane shot in that movie. With Gangster Squad, there's a sense that they weren't sure how they wanted to approach it. The dialogue at times is snappy, like the old days. The aesthetic in the first half seems interesting. It's not so forcefully trying to recall the starkness of those past films like Dahlia did, but rather hints at it with smart uses of digital coloring, subtle lighting techniques. But then the second half, like the plot, seems to forget all of that. It basically just becomes an action movie shoot-'em-up. It indulges in itself. Not to say it isn't entertaining, it totally is. It's just that where at first it feels like you're about to get an interesting film, something with meaning like an L.A. Confidential, we really just end up getting a CBS-style crime drama with a bigger budget.
I think maybe this movie might be creating its own sub-genre, video game noir. It just feels like inspired by the kinds of narratives, the kind of cutscenes, the kind of action sequences you've come to expect from games like Grand Theft Auto or L.A. Noir, stuff like
and
that.
And the sort of post-production digital coloring, I think,
is starting to put a
link between those two that I don't think we expected.
Yep. Well, my rating is 3 on the verge of a heart attack, Nick Nolte head shakes, and 1 neck to give to Nick Nolte. Because apparently he whittled his down after years of head shaking. Did you see it? It was like it's just his head is sitting on top of his shoulders.
He looks like a giant albino gorilla.
That's correct. Nick Nolte, more like no neck Nolte.
Whoa!
Hey.
Looks like we just found our villain for Dick Tracy 2.
Oh, man.
My rating, actually, before I give my rating, I do want to say that there's a really great supporting performance in this movie by Robert Patrick as like an old gunslinger.
Yeah.
One of the redeeming things.
He plays Wyatt Earp, essentially.
But it works.
Yeah.
So my rating is 100 guns, 1 knife, a bottle of acid, a beer delivering Nick Nolte. I know this sounds good so far.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
But then there's also an absence of purpose. So, 0 purpose.
Well, apparently you didn't watch the fucking movie, David, because the purpose of this movie is to save the soul of Los Angeles. Well, now that movie time is over, we need to take a time out to recognize the folks that keep the generators running and the restless natives at bay. Geeks of Doom has all the best geek-related scoops on comics, movies, television, and pop culture paraphernalia. Help us avoid certain death and visit geeksofdoom.com. Now, back to the show. All right, guys, it's time for the third segment. Now, things have gotten a little weird on the island.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, we received a radio transmission from a man named Sean O'Connell, who he's a film critic. You've probably read his work for Cinema Blend, Movies.com, Fandango, Washington Post, mm-hmm. Daily Bugle. I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
And we were talking about our best supporting actors and actresses of 2012, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we lost connection with him. I don't know what happened. He has a tiger in his boat.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, do you think we could reestablish communication with him and try to maybe, I don't know, talk about lead actors?
Sure. Yeah, we should try. I mean, he could be dead by now, but Sean O'Connell, are you out there? Can you hear us?
Sean. Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, I think he's dead.
Man. Hello?
Oh.
Hey.
Hey.
Sean.
Hello?
Sean!
He lives!
Can you hear us?
Dad?
No, no, it's not your dad. It's those three idiots from the island that you talked to about 5 to 7 days ago.
The fuck have you guys been?
We've been busy.
Just been busy, man.
Island life, man. It's tough.
Guys, I've been on this boat for a week with no contact from anybody except this tiger who's trying to eat me every hour on the hour.
Have the Disney cruise people at least sent you more fruit snacks?
Nothing. Nothing.
They're savages.
They threw me an empty bottle that I've been using for bodily functions.
This is why I'm so unhappy that they're in control of Star Wars.
Nice to hear from you guys again.
Yeah, we're glad you're alive.
Yes. Yeah, it's been delightful so far.
It's great. It's yet another coincidence because we are, of course, talking about our top performances by a leading actor and actress.
Oh, fantastic.
And it'd be wonderful if you could join us.
I think I can.
Cool.
Perfect. Let's go.
All right.
Well, just like last week, we won't go through the formality of spinning the Mystic Spinner.
I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, David.
No. We're going to go actors first?
Yep.
All right. My number three lead actor is Jack Black in Bernie.
Mm.
I thought that this was a really phenomenal role for him.
Excellent. So. Tim?
I totally agree. He's my number three as well.
What?
Whoa. What I love about his portrayal, and maybe it's just good casting as well, but you love him like right off the bat.
Yeah.
You're just like, I love this guy, just like everyone in the small town in Texas does. And that really presents the conflict in the end.
My number three pick is Shirzay Sharma as Pai Patel in The Life of Pi.
Mm.
This is the first movie he's ever done in his life.
Yeah.
And he was incredible. I bought every part of his entire journey. And I was so involved. Like Sean, I mean, Sean's on a boat with a tiger. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's not an easy thing. That happens like maybe twice in a lifetime.
I hope next year you're acknowledging me and my performance alongside Richard Parker.
Yeah.
Are you filming your isolation on that boat?
Of course.
Is Werner Herzog making a documentary about you? Live free or pie hard?
Live free or pie hard.
Oh, yeah.
I went with Richard Gere in a movie that maybe not a lot of people saw called Arbitrage. Okay, so it's Gere playing, operating at his most gearness.
Yeah. You might say he kicked it up a gear.
I was going to say.
He's running in high gear.
I was going to say they geared this movie to him.
And yet, even though it's sort of Gere playing Gere, it's still such a tremendous performance. He plays a Wall Street guy. He has an affair. He's having an affair. He's married to Susan Sarandon. He's got essentially the perfect life.
Yeah, Britt Marling is his daughter.
Britt Marling's his daughter. And then, you know, something really sudden happens, and he has to sort of put out a ton of fires. I was so just engrossed in his performance, and it was so great to see Gere just sink his teeth into a role again. It's a great mystery thriller that just has tremendous performances all the way through it, and I think probably Gere's best work in years, so I put him at number three.
Hmm. I'm sold. I'm going to check that out.
Well, if you're not busy grinding your gears.
Oh, my goodness.
Enough.
All right, my number two is actually Joaquin Phoenix in The Master. I thought that this performance was just so transformative for him. And I mean, just
literally
there are, yeah, like every year there's always one or two that you just see people like change the entirety of their physicality, everything about them. This performance is undeniable. I mean, it's just, it's an incredible.
His poor back.
I know,
man.
The way his stance all the time, putting his hands back on his hips, like just everything about it. I can't even explain it.
I can see that. You look like a bumbling idiot.
I think we got to take a moment to sort of acknowledge the fact that whoever works with Paul Thomas Anderson usually gives the best performance of their career. I mean, obviously Sandler. I don't think Mark Wahlberg has been better than he was in Boogie Nights.
I agree.
Daniel Day-Lewis Shooter. Has had a slew of performances to choose from, but he was pretty tremendous in There Will Be Blood. So, and then
this is all true.
Yes,
everything's true that Sean is saying.
David, we are dueling lists here.
Son of a bitch.
So transformative. I like what you said about transformative. Just the hunch that he gives, and the one scene that that really had me is the don't blink scene. And
oh man,
oh my god, yes,
yeah,
fantastic.
Joaquin Phoenix's eyes, you know, and I found myself most of the way through that scene not blinking, and I realized that I was not blinking.
Yeah,
that's because of Joaquin Phoenix's performance.
My number two was, we've already talked about it, Jack Black as Bernie Tita in Bernie.
Cool.
And just fantastic. Mm. And I thought he was so genuine and warm and endearing. And then he gets into this, situation with Shirley MacLaine's character, and you legitimately feel sorry for him, and he feels trapped and stuck, and you sympathize with him and understand why he would want to, you know, kill her.
Yeah.
And then when it happens, you are conflicted. Well, you know, obviously this is illegal. You took someone's life.
Right, right.
You have to kind of go on that journey completely, and I think that's the best performance he's ever given, and he should be looked at more for dramatic work, I think.
Yeah, I would disagree with you in the best performance, though. I think that's Neverending Story 2.
I was going to say Waterworld was really good in that. But man, Neverending Story 2, you might have me there.
I went with Bradley Cooper for the Silver Linings Playbook.
Mm. Interesting.
Primarily because I just didn't think Bradley Cooper had this in him. I thought he was just the frat boy hangover dude. I got to give Bradley Cooper a ton of credit for just rising to David O. Russell's level. It's such a great script, in the fact that it has to be delivered at a certain pace. And Bradley Cooper just shows an aggression that I didn't think he had in him. And he's able to really counter it with a ton of honesty. And you're so used to just seeing like phony Hollywood bullshit. And this movie slices through that and is led by Bradley Cooper. I never thought I'd say that about a Bradley Cooper movie, and I thought he was phenomenal.
Well, I'm going to do something that I think is also going to piss off Adam
again. Oh, my God.
Just like last week.
Jesus.
I completely disagree with almost the entirety of this film, but I think it is, once again, it's undeniable, the performance.
Battleship.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson.
Yeah. Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis is Lincoln. I don't care what anybody says. It's incredible.
It is incredible.
It's an unbelievable performance.
It's so unbelievable, it's believable.
Like
every fucking movie does.
Like that's the thing. The thing about watching this movie. This was how good it was. Is that watching this movie, which was painful at points, most points, is you are still. I was still in awe every time he was talking.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I had problems with certain parts of the script, everything
now,
like that.
Now. No, I agree. It's fully deserving. We all know he's going to get the Oscar. He could have just been a janitor, you know, in the background or for a good time call picking up street trash, and we would have gave him the fucking Oscar. It's no question. He's incredible. Who cares?
I'm done. For a good time call when?
Now?
I just,
that's his Oscar clip.
Yeah.
So badly.
All right, Tim?
My number one is Denzel Washington in Flight.
Preach. Mm-hmm.
I know Denzel Washington has nothing to do with the way his stubble looks.
You'd think that.
But I'm attributing that to this performance. I think, you know, the control that he has over his stubble.
It's good stubble.
He has a magical face.
Yeah, it's an addict stubble. It's an alcoholic stubble.
You're right. Takes one to know one, Grant.
He is so convincing in this role.
Yes.
And yeah, I'll just stop there. It's simply just
the first 7 minutes of the movie. It's over. You can't help but to not understand who he is. You're invested in his character, and he's just a joy to watch the whole way through. With that being said, that's my number one pick. Denzel Washington, Flight. I mean, sure, maybe it's a bit generic, the struggles of an addict. We've seen that time and time again, I guess. But he just brought something to it that made it feel more real and less TV melodramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, coincidentally, my number one is Denzel Washington in Flight.
Wow.
I'm so glad, because now he can say all the things that I don't know how to say. So right. Go for it.
Right.
I think what's really, really special about his performance is that we don't like him, and he actively does not like us either.
Yes.
Anyone who's watching him, you're supposed to hate him. And I think there's very few performers, because performers so desperately want to be loved by the people who are singing in that theater and watching them.
Anne Hathaway.
And cheering. Well, yes, not to circle back around to her. Denzel goes the opposite direction. He's most comfortable when you're kind of not sure how you feel about him, and you're only really not sure because we've been trained for years to like the leading actor. And when he plays roles, you know, he's often at his best in things like Training Day, where he's going against the grain and playing someone who is making really despicable choices. Hmm. And I think with Whip, he's given a lot of opportunities to do the right thing, and he holds off doing it for selfish reasons.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many people who are going to bat for him to get him off the hook. And again, for their own selfish reasons, the FAA is trying to get him off. The pilots union is trying to get him off. And all he wants to do is keep drinking and lose himself in this. But he just clung to, you know, his addiction, because it was the only thing that made him feel normal. And I found that to be fascinating. I found it to be fascinating because that's not the movie I thought we were getting into. I thought it was going to be about a plane crash and this hero who saved these people. And it's not that movie at all. And Denzel Washington completely fucking sells it. And the best scene in the movie, too, because Zemeckis has to get a lot of credit for coming back to live action, but again, Zemeckis is another guy who gets the best performances out of his leads. Tom Hanks in Castaway is genius. Obviously Denzel in this, but it's the scene with the in the hotel room where he's able to get into the room next to him, and the hum of the refrigerator comes over the background, and it's like one of the scariest sounds you've heard
really
on
is.
Screen, because you're like, you realize what he's going to tip over into, and and it's the power of Denzel that you're as invested in his potential demise that we are at that point. And so, and the best part about Flight, too, the reason why it's a good film and one that we should be talking about, is that Zemeckis doesn't cheat. You know, he fucking lets him go over the edge, and he gets him drunk. And he brings John Goodman in, and John Goodman brings this man cocaine to wake him up, and that's the point that we cheer. We're like, yes, cocaine!
Yes! Banana boats!
Cocaine so he can lie to this board.
Yeah.
Those are all these things that they just manipulate the way that you're supposed to feel during a regular film.
Yeah.
And all of those elements play into the fact that makes Flight a very special film, and makes Denzel the number one best actor performance. So, tremendous. And when he loses to now, it'll be a shame.
All right. What are we doing next?
Actress. We're going with the actress.
Top three performances by an actress in a lead role. And
yeah.
I believe it is to you.
My number three is, and I don't care what anybody says, but it's Keira Knightley and Anna Karenina. I thought she was great.
Fantastic.
Okay. I thought she was so great.
Great choice.
That she actually did not deter Adam from liking a movie with her in a dress.
That's very true.
And I think that is enough.
My number three, Keira Knightley, Anna Karenina.
Wow. Okay.
My dear brother, David.
we're so on the same wavelength this time.
I think that she plays the tragedy really well.
Yeah.
Agreed.
By the third act, you feel bad for her, but then again, you're like, you kind of fucked yourself over.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I don't really feel so bad for her.
Her performance puts a lot of thoughts in your head that should be there.
Yeah.
And that's why she's my number three.
I also think that I think where she starts in this film is kind of where Adam always feels that she exists. In
yes,
that
it's a great way of saying
she's
it.
She's in the relationship already, you know, and she expects to just sort of coast through as quote unquote Keira Knightley in a period piece, you know. And it's the fact that that comfortable bubble that she lives in gets rattled. That I think makes her have to sort of rise up as an actress and take it in a different direction. And I thought she did beyond what I even expected.
Cool.
And I'm gay.
Just right. Please give us
my number three. My number three is Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Kate Hanna in Smashed. A couplet to Denzel's performance in Flight. She plays a alcoholic, but she is an elementary school teacher, and she lives this life of just constant partying and drinking, and it spins out of control. And I think she gives her first truly remarkable lead role.
I thought she was better than the movie. You know,
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she overpowers the movie with her performance. Yeah. While watching it, I was kind of like, you know, this is her Rachel getting married.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
So I feel like, obviously, I don't think Smashed is as good of a movie as Rachel getting married, but I think her performance is that strong that hopefully she gets more lead work.
She was really good in Live Free or Die Hard.
God damn you, Sean! Tim, can we cut the line? Can you?
My turn. My number three for performance in an actress by an actress in a lead role goes to Naomi Watts in The Impossible.
Yes.
And again, this is a performance where she has to act against some amazing special effects, you know, Spielberg level special effects.
Yep.
And she doesn't give the lazy Spielberg face, you know, where they just sort of look out at a fixed point in the distance.
True.
And have the camera zoom in on them slowly. She just gives a guttural, intense performance that's completely born of parental love. And I don't even know if she could have played it, you know, a few years ago, but she's had a few kids, and she has to play this mother who is trying to hold herself together. Her performance blew me away. I thought it was great. So,
my number two is Jennifer Lawrence, Silver Linings Playbook.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kudos.
I thought she was great. I think that this is probably she. I was trying to figure out a way to say it. It's almost like I felt like she played this role so perfectly in the sense that. She managed to kind of, I think in like a typical romantic comedy, which I think this movie's kind of like the real life version of what, you know, these situations would be.
Yeah.
Which is makes sense for Russell and what he's been doing recently. But she would have been either just really, really crazy or, you know, just a bit more emotional. And I feel like she had this perfect balance to where she was presenting crazy and you always knew that it was a front. But it was because it was hiding this sort of emotional fragility that she had. And I agree that the rest of the performances are really, really fantastic. The movie in general is fantastic, but her performance just generally kind of stole the show for me.
My number two is Gretchen Lodge in Lovely Molly.
Wow. Now this is an incredible pick.
So Lovely Molly is a horror film. And it's actually, in my opinion, a really solid horror film. Very, very scary. And what Gretchen Lodge does is she plays against this 20-something blonde-haired girl that you see in horror films. What Gretchen Lodge does is she plays against that. And where there are these moments in the film where you should be turned on if it was a popcorn piece of shit horror film.
Jesus.
That you clearly don't like.
Okay.
You are terrified by her. There are a few sex scenes in this film, and you are truly scared what she's going to do.
Yeah, it's very true.
And I love that juxtaposition that the filmmakers and her pull off. And she goes from being this kind of frail woman to being tormented to being just an absolutely terrifying presence toward the end of the film. It's quite a transformation.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, we talked about Zero Dark Thirty last week, where I gushed over Jessica Chastain and how much I love her. And it's no surprise that she's my number two for the year as Maya in Zero Dark Thirty, and we pretty much said everything you could say about it last week in our review. But I do think she brings across this like quiet, obsessive desperation, a loner, which is, you know, that character kind of pops up quite a bit in Kathryn Bigelow's films. But I think she did a great job with actually not doing a whole lot.
She should have gone on the last mission, though, right? She should have suited up with those guys.
It would have been badass if she had just paratrooped down with, like, a bazooka.
Or if, like, Bin Laden got the jump on them, you know? If he was like, I'm got you now. And then she came through and she was like, I'm the motherfucker who found you, bitch. And, like, shot him in the head.
Get away from them, you bitch.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Zero Dark Thirty fan fiction.
Yeah, that's I'm just going to happen.
Starts now.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
All right.
My number two is also Jennifer Lawrence from Silver Linings Playbook. And I think that you can only really describe her in this movie as a force. Like, she's just a complete and total force of energy. And the thing about the thing that I love about her performance is that I never once got a whiff of her acting in it at all. I just believed that she was this person. And she, like you say, she has to really, she struck a great balance between this girl who has a ton of baggage because she's a widow and she's been meted up and people don't know what to expect from her because, you know, they all sort of tiptoe around her. Even with the first dinner party, they tiptoe around both Bradley Cooper and her. She maintains such complete control over a character who is not supposed to have any control. And at the end of the movie, she goes toe-to-toe with De Niro. And she goes toe-to-toe with the good De Niro. It's not like Terry Polo in a Meet the Parents sequel. It's a legitimate actress who shouldn't be as refined as she is at her young age. Go back to Winter's Bone, too, where she was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Off the charts good.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And so just to see the fact that she's continuing to build on it and build on it in different and other type of roles, I'm thrilled.
Great.
Cool.
Number one.
Number one for me is Jessica Chastain in Zero Dark Thirty.
Yep.
I think that this movie, as fantastic as this movie is, I think it would be half as good if she wasn't in it.
Yep.
She just, I feel like it's kind of like you said that she, you know, she does so much with so little, like without doing some, like she's barely... There's just not a lot of action for this character in the film.
Yeah.
But there's so much emotion she goes through. And she shows it to you in like two or three points in big ways, whether it be kind of hiding in the corner or the final scene where she, you know, kind of finally gets to like let go. But then I feel like there's other, throughout the rest of the film, there's just the way that she like carries herself and... the opening scene where she's in the room while they're, you know, interrogating this guy and how she's like shying from it. But then within those first like 5 minutes, you get to see her subtly changing and saying like, no, I have to accept this. This is my job. Like, and then,
well,
and
she gets to play us. I mean, she's essentially she's the eyes and ears.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
To the point where at the very end, when she lets out that relief, like we let out that relief.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's her finally accepting like all the emotions that she's been pushing down all those years. Like, and I think the other thing too is I'm learning this about Chastain. This is one of the things I like about her because I think this is a sign of a really great performer is that she tells us so much with her eyes. Like 70% of whatever emotion or
those gorgeous feeling eyes
is conveyed with her eyes. And that is so hard to do. And I think she's really, really like phenomenal at it. And this movie, that much of her performance is based on subtleties like that.
Yep.
And I thought it was just fantastic. I think it's the best performance she's given yet. So,
Tim.
My number one, Jennifer Lawrence. Silver Linings Playbook. Thank you. Thank you. What I love about her character is she is smart.
Yes.
And I think that this film dealing with mental illness... It does it so well because it doesn't undercut the intelligence of these characters. She walks into every scene and assesses the scene, assesses everyone in the scene.
Yeah.
And she plots out what she's going to do. I think that, Sean, you talking about her going toe-to-toe with De Niro, you know, she knows exactly what buttons to push for him.
Yep.
And she executes that brilliantly.
And how bad could that scene have been with a, you know, her spouting off the sports statistics of the results of the games?
Oh, yeah.
It could have been, you know, if anyone else sort of tried to spit those out at De Niro, you'd be like...
Like Reese Witherspoon.
Right. You'd kind of think like, well, she wouldn't know this and this is really badly scripted.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but she just sells it. She sells everything that she does in that movie.
Yeah.
And you want them to get together. You like her.
Yes.
Even though they're both a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
So, I love it. She's my number one.
Well, let's not linger on it. My number one is Jennifer Lawrence, Silver Linings.
There you go.
It's my favorite, maybe my favorite performance of the year in general. Like you guys have been saying, I feel like she's super authentic and genuine in her madness and trying to cope with that, and how honest she is in all those scenes where she's talking about how she slept with everyone at work. And,
yeah.
But I think what really pushed it over for me was the whole, once you get into preparing for the dance number and seeing her, her dedication to actually dancing on her own. She has her own thing that's not a part of Bradley Cooper's universe, and I really enjoyed that, because most if this movie was your generic rom-com, it would just kind of be like, this girl is hanging out. She doesn't really have her own story. She's simply there to play to the male characters, you know,
right,
idiosyncrasies and stuff like that. But I liked that she had this own thing that she was using to try to better herself and focus, and that she was able to bring Bradley Cooper's character in that, and Chris Tucker, of course, who was fantastic in that scene.
Yeah.
And leading up to the end, and like Tim was saying, going toe-to-toe against De Niro and assessing every situation, just thought she was brilliant across the board.
Not to mention, I can't remember her name, but the mom.
Oh, Jackie Weaver.
Man, she is powerful, too.
Great.
Like, that's, I feel like she played the sort of, you know, quiet
wife
mom in this movie, but she is definitely a presence.
Yeah, we haven't talked about her enough.
So she's
very understated performance.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
My turn?
Yep.
I went with the incredibly sexy pick at number one of Emmanuelle Riva from The War, the 750-year-old actress who plays a woman who is dying slowly and is making us watch every last breath that she takes. And not only is it a completely harrowing and emotionally bare performance, I still can't completely wrap my brain around the fact that a woman at that age would accept a script and a role that made her have to confront her own mortality, because she has to realize that she's much closer to actually dying than she is far away from it. And here, you know, Michael Haneke is putting her through the rigors of having to, you know, take multiple takes, and here's where you're going to slap your husband because you don't know who he is anymore. And it's a really tough sit when you're just doing it for 100 minutes, let alone filming it for however many weeks it took them to film it.
Yeah.
And these people have come out and said, the actors have come out and said that they had a lot of laughs on the set and that they kept it light, which I think is great and very, very healthy for them.
Yeah.
But the two of them together in this movie are so unbelievably good. And I think, you know, when you add on the fact that Riva, I think, had to sort of get over this own obstacle of accepting her own mortality, but just the fact that she's playing a woman who has been with her husband for decades and has to pretend that she doesn't know who he is anymore. And you know, it's such a difficult part. And they just pulled it off so well. I mean, it's the best movie I hope I never have to see again.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I saw it. And I'm so glad that I'm so glad I saw it in a theater where it was dark, and we were at a festival, and you could hear a pin drop. I mean, everybody was just so caught up in this story, and I don't think, like, as good as the other people are in their movies, I still always felt like we were watching movies. And with this, with Amore, I really felt like we were watching a legitimate couple playing out their last few days. And although that's a really tough movie to sell to somebody, like, hey, Amore, date night, you know, for dinner, and then go watch these two people march toward death. She's so wonderful. It's the best female performance I saw last year.
I saw a really funny tweet actually about a Moore, and someone was like, what if they did a William Castle-esque theater gimmick where they fill the theater with 70 and 80-year-olds, and then you get to go in there and watch a Moore with them? And I was like, that is brilliant. Well, if I'm doing my math right, that's...
Which you normally don't.
Correct. So could you check?
Yeah. Could you double solve, check your math?
Yeah, solve.
I believe that was it.
Yeah, that's it.
Carry the one. We got it.
Sean, what? Give us an update on your situation.
I don't want to look around because I fear you guys are going to leave me again for another week. But you know, I'm sure by next week I'll be rescued. So
hey, there's silver linings. Yeah. Silver linings.
Silver linings.
See you, Sean.
Good luck.
See you, boss.
Gentlemen, good luck.
Well, we wish Sean the best of luck in his endeavors, and I mean, I can only pray to T'Challa that we get to speak to him again. That concludes another transmission from Skullface Island. As always, you can call the Skullface Island hotline at 980-272-0111 or email us at skullfaceisland@gmail.com. Tweet us at Skullface Island and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Skullface Island. You can also follow us on Google+ by searching for Skullface Island. Do my eyebrows look okay?
Mm-hmm.
They look good.
Yeah.
Because I was...
I mean, they're not Michael Keaton good, but
well,
good.
Sure, I don't have the grooming tools.
Nor do you have the brow.
David.
Yeah.
Listen, I saw you staring at my my canoe with wheels.
No, I wasn't.
You were. And I just... Okay. I want to ask you, you don't have to be ashamed about it.
Yeah, we're all friends here.
You don't know how to drive, do you?
Well, David... David, you're 28.
I just haven't found the time. All right? I'm scared of it.
Do you want to learn how to drive, David?
Will you help me?
You'll have to find someone else.